This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So, on to the talk. I actually first attended this conference about 13 years ago, around the time of the Arab Spring. Very momentous time, I think, for a lot of folks on the left. It's what brought me to socialist politics. So I'm really excited for Sam's talk and for the discussion today. A little bit about Sam. Sam Kimball is an independent journalist reporting from the Middle East and North Africa since 2011. Based in Cyprus most recently, but recently moved to New York again. And he has covered Syria, Yemen, Egypt, Morocco, Lebanon, Tunisia, Libya, and Iraq. Sam will speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll open it up to discussion, and I'll talk about how that works when we get there.
Can you all hear me?
Good, great. All right. Going to take my mask down to speak a little more easily. All right, I'm going to try and keep this short and concise, but it's a lot of history to cover. It's a lot of events to cover. I'll try not to go over too much. So here we go. Let me start off by saying that I am not from the MENA region. I have, however, lived in several of the countries I will discuss for months or years, worked in them, and I speak Arabic. I am not an academic expert. Rather, I'm speaking here in the style of a community teach-in to offer the nuts and bolts of the Arab Spring to newcomers and non-specialists. This is a huge space to cover in a short period of time. I can only give the broad strokes of history, though I encourage others to fill the gaps where possible. If you are seeking expert knowledge in any of these countries, there are books by scholars and activists and journalists in the book room, and I can recommend a few names afterwards if people are interested. And there are a few comrades who know many other books and articles and authors to recommend as well. There are those books in the book room. And some of those authors are here today at the conference, like the scholar Adam Haniyeh. I strongly encourage anyone from or connected to the MENA region to speak and share your thoughts and experience. So the Arab Spring broke out in Tunisia in 2010 after the self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi, an informal street vendor and a peasant whose vegetable cart was taken by police in Sidi Bouzid, an area hit by the starkest effects of the poverty and exploitation to which Tunisia is subject. But the revolt quickly spread to other countries in MENA, and here I'm using MENA, Middle East, North Africa, as a shorthand for Southwest Asia and the northern part of Africa, the largely Arabic-speaking region. The revolt quickly spread to other countries in MENA, experiencing very similar economic conditions and political models. The importance of the Arab Spring cannot be overstated. It was a multinational, region-wide explosion of anger and creativity that overthrew seven, maybe more, of the world's longest reigning autocratic rulers, often backed militarily and financially and politically by the US and other imperial powers like France, the UK, Russia, and others. The movements in each country drew in broad cross-sections of society, from impoverished farmers to the urban unemployed youth, to women and ethnic minority groups, to trade unions, NGOs, middle-class professionals, and defecting soldiers. They broke through walls of silence imposed on criticism by police states, facing arrest, bullets, and torture, often all three, while demanding shogol, hurriya, karama wataniya, work, freedom, national dignity. It was perhaps the first such rebellion of this scale we had seen since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the uprisings against the Soviet Union in the late 1980s and early 90s. And in some places, the spontaneous mass movements were successful in removing heads of state, and indeed sometimes whole governments that had been in place for decades, who had overseen the impoverishment and repression of their own populations. The uprisings forced national dialogues, new constitutions, and in Tunisia installed a liberal democratic government for some time, and we'll discuss what happened to that government. The Arab Spring inspired mass movements for radical economic and political change in Spain, Greece, Ivory Coast, Russia, Turkey, Iran, Mali, the Occupy Wall Street movement right here in the US, and far beyond. And it prompted a new generation of activists worldwide to suddenly see that mass action could indeed effect radical, or at the very least significant, social and political change. But for us, as radicals and revolutionaries, the Arab Spring must serve as more than just a few months or a couple of years of acceleration and excitement about the change happening over there. Rather, it should be an opportunity to learn from this historical moment of rebellion and democratic organizing in this key region of capitalist resource control, a region which is also the neighborhood around the colonial outpost of Israel and a laboratory of neoliberalism. To learn how these movements made the gains they did, how they were vulnerable to counter-revolution, but also their legacy in terms of tactics used, weaknesses of the ruling class and foreign powers, and how we can show concrete solidarity towards such movements when they arise. Some questions we might consider, among many others. What are the unique ways in which capitalism affects this region, the MENA region, and creates the conditions for revolt? Why were these uprisings and revolutions so similar? Why did none of them bring to power truly revolutionary states or political systems? What kind of changes in consciousness have occurred among populations in the MENA region that may bolster further revolutionary action? So, before I get into the revolutionary uprisings themselves, let's just talk about a bit of the material and economic and political circumstances that laid the tinder for these explosions. There were contradictions in the economy building from the 1980s, we could say the 1970s, until the revolutions broke out in 2010. This included the failure of the Arab nationalist and Arab socialist projects, which promised to protect their populations from the predatory effects of imperialism and unite the peoples of the Arabic-speaking world. There was the broad imposition of neoliberalism, which brought with it the cutting of public sector jobs, removals of key subsidies on things like bread, fuel, and housing, reversal of land reform, granting free rein to private landlords, which caused mass rural to urban migration of peasants, many of whom were forced into peripheral urban ghettos. Less and less were ruling regimes using welfare systems based on the sale of resources like oil and gas and obtaining international aid to maintain social peace between workers and the bourgeoisie, and meanwhile exercising autocratic control over politics. More and more, the situation became autocratic political control, appeasement of local economic elites, the servitude towards the World Bank and IMF, and no support for workers' daily needs. This was combined with severe internal repression of political opposition movements, labor movements, and eventually any kind of dissenting opinion. This was conditioned by an ideology of national unity and avoiding any kind of class conflict. Finally, there was a sense of betrayal among many Arab populations with peacemaking and appeasement by Arab leaders who once had put forth an anti-imperialist front in earlier times. There was Anwar Sadat in Egypt and his 1978 Camp David peace accords with Israel, which defanged the most powerful Arab adversary to Israel. His follower, President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, his government actively supported the American war on terror and reinforced the border wall and siege on Gaza. Gaddafi, a longtime rhetorician of anti-imperialism and leader in Libya, was by the 2000s reconciling with Western leaders like George Bush, Blair, and Berlusconi. And then in Syria, it was used as a subcontractor for the U.S. torture program during the war on terror. And Syria remained almost entirely inactive against Israel's occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights. So this meant that despite the rhetoric, there was no actual resistance to Western imperialism and Israeli settler colonialism by the Arab governments by the 2000s. So the explosion came in Tunisia, as I mentioned, in December 2010 in Sidi Bouzid, a deeply impoverished and deprived interior region of Tunisia. It spread to other underdeveloped interior regions where infrastructure is battered or non-existent, where there is food insecurity and illiteracy. And some of us may remember from those times grainy cell phone footage in those first days showing masses of people in rural towns battling with police in small streets, the images of wavering shots of protesters frantically administering first aid to their comrades wounded by live fire. And then images of a sea of protesters surrounding the menacing headquarters of the Interior Ministry in Tunis, screaming, "Dégage, get out." The revolt quickly spread to the UGTT Labor Federation, the largest of its kind in the MENA region, the parliamentary left, the Tunisian General Student Union, politicized lawyers, human rights defenders, and universities. Then it spread to the poor youth of the deeply marginalized urban neighborhoods who attacked and burned police stations. There were mass labor strikes, and eventually, in January of 2011, President Ben Ali fled to Saudi Arabia. Following was Egypt, where protesters inspired by Tunisia planned a protest in Cairo on National Police Day. On January 25th, protests broke out around the country. Police were sent in battling with protesters and eventually withdrew, and divisions of the army were sent in. Thugs on camels and horseback were also sent in to attack protesters. Mubarak made some concessions, which the protesters promptly rejected. Mubarak finally stepped down in February of 2011. However, massive worker mobilization continued across all sectors of the economy despite the ouster of Mubarak, and continued long thereafter. And some may also remember the images on TV of the televised announcement that Mubarak had stepped down and the fireworks exploding over the millions of people camping out in Tahrir Square and filling Cairo's streets. In Libya, protests began in January 2011, very tepidly, in the underdeveloped and marginalized East, demanding access to housing they had been promised. The protest then spread to many parts of the country, attacking police stations, radio, TV, and so-called Revolutionary Committee offices. Protesters were shot with live fire. Within days, members of the military began to defect. Volunteers created fighting units to defend against Libyan military attacks, and some of these defectors joined them. Very importantly, NATO intervened in the fighting, bombing Gaddafi's forces from the air, and major battles went on for 7 to 8 months, ending when Gaddafi was captured and brutally killed. In Bahrain, the tiny Gulf state, it experienced a mass uprising calling for the removal of the king and a new constitutional monarchy, which was severely repressed with deadly violence from local authorities and the Saudi military, which was sent in. For a variety of reasons, I will not go into it in this talk, but happy to discuss it in the discussion. I recommend that folks do. In Yemen, inspired by Tunisia and Egypt, protesters gathered to call for President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had been president for 33 years, to step down. They denounced corruption, and a lack of political representation. Interestingly, these protests were organized by Yemeni opposition groups. They were therefore less leaderless and kind of structurally ethereal than Tunisia and Egypt. Saleh granted some political and salary concessions. These were immediately rejected by protesters who saw it as a kind of sleight of hand to appease them. His forces then went on to massacre dozens of protesters at an encampment in Sana'a, the capital. Ministers and MPs began to resign, and a commander of an important army division defected and said he would protect the protesters. A journalist friend of mine who was there at the time in 2011 said, in Yemen, women marshaled rallies, slept in protest camps, went on hunger strikes, and covered the unrest as bloggers and photographers. They were also among the hundreds of protesters killed during the government's bloody crackdown. This was very significant in what is generally a highly gender-segregated society like Yemen, and women really were in the fore of this revolutionary uprising. Saleh was badly injured in a bombing of the presidential palace. And finally, in early 2012, a new president was voted in a one-man election. In Syria, peaceful protests erupted after 15 boys were detained and tortured for writing graffiti in support of the ongoing Arab Spring in the south of the country. Protests then spread to Damascus and Aleppo. Now, initially, protesters had rather modest demands, demanding democratic reforms, the release of political prisoners, allowing more political parties to participate, and calling for an end to a 50-year state of emergency. I was in Damascus when the first protests broke out in Daraa, in the south. Protests spread to the Damascus suburb of Douma, where I was teaching English. And these protests were some of the first to be met with live fire. I remember I was on the bus on my way to work when the language center secretary called me one day and said, no need to come in today. I said, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. He said, not tomorrow or the next day. The Arabic-speaking foreigner without work papers had become a liability under heavy police surveillance. But I also saw close Syrian friends who once saw President Bashar al-Assad as a protector have rude psychological awakenings when the protests were put down with deadly force. One told me, I feel like I was tricked for my whole life. In July 2011, defected officers announced the formation of the Free Syrian Army to remove President Assad. And by July 2012, the Red Cross declared the conflict a civil war. So, within a year, multiple autocratic presidents stepped down or were forcibly overthrown. This was unprecedented in the simultaneity of the uprisings, their number over an entire region in a short time span, and the level of mass political participation at the street level. The gains. In Tunisia, banned political parties were allowed to re-enter politics. There were improvements in freedom of expression, presidential elections, and a new constitution drafted. In Libya, for a couple of years, a parliamentary democracy was set up, greater participation of women and ethnic minorities in politics, and regional autonomy. In Egypt, there was greater activity among organized labor, opening up of political party activity and freedom of expression for a limited time until a coup a couple of years later. In Syria, there was freedom of expression in some areas at some times that were able to escape government control. And the activation of the masses in self-governing local coordinating committees. In Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, after 33 years, was ousted from power. There were elections for president, yes, with one candidate. And a national dialogue conference was convened with representatives of all segments of society to exchange views on the transition and drafting a new constitution. So now there was a plethora of countries with political systems destabilized after decades of violently enforced stability. These were systems that were often directly bolstered by imperial powers. It was earth-shaking, but to the ruling classes of the world, very dangerous. And the region was left in an ambiguous state, with some liberal democratic regimes fully or partly built, and others in a state of civil war, and in Bahrain, what I would argue was a nearly complete defeat. The reaction and rollbacks were immediate. In Tunisia, there was a clampdown on sit-ins demanding that the rest of the former ruling party members depart. There was the encouragement of ultra-conservative Salafists who attacked and, in some cases, assassinated leftists. There was the election of Beji Qaad al-Sabsi, a former Bourguiba and Ben Ali government official, going back to the days of Tunisia's independence. Implementation of a state of emergency law after some terrorist attacks, and the election, finally, of conservative president Kais Saied, who carried out a coup d'etat in 2021, and an ensuing massive attack on the judiciary, speech rights, and protest. In Libya, as I mentioned, there was NATO intervention, which distorted the course of the Revolutionary War. Foreign powers flooded Libya with weapons. The counter-revolutionary military leader Khalifa Haftar, who had been living in the United States prior to that, emerged, creating a new authoritarian state similar to Gaddafi's. There was the rise and growth of ISIS in Libya. And Haftar conducted a campaign against the government in Tripoli in 2019, supported by direct Russian intervention. In Egypt, the military rushed to form an alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamist party, hoping to slow the revolutionary tide. There was the election of the Muslim Brotherhood Mohamed Morsi as president, who tried to appease the army. In July 2013, the army finally conducted a coup against Morsi. They massacred anti-coup protesters in the hundreds and thousands. And military courts began prosecuting thousands of civilians, so much so that new prisons had to be constructed. In Syria, the regime responded by presenting the uprising as a foreign conspiracy and strove to sow ethnic, inter-ethnic and intersect strife. Russia used its veto power in the UN to protect the regime of Bashar al-Assad. There was the rise of ISIS controlling swaths of Syrian territory but making deals with Bashar al-Assad's regime. There was the organization of sectarian militias that killed and terrorized revolutionary activists. Iran immediately intervened with weapons and pro-regime militias. There was the invitation of Russian military intervention, who bombed revolutionaries from the sky. And the country, which is the situation now, was divided into multiple occupation zones with the US, Iran, Russia, Turkey, a Kurdish zone, and a Syrian government fiefdom. The reaction from the local ruling classes, ruling family cabals, and foreign powers was immediate. Whether trying to flood post-revolutionary governments with loans, co-opt revolutionary activists into liberal NGO culture, politically and economically support right-wing governments or the military, or literally drown the revolutionary spaces in weapons and bomb them into hunger and disarray. Now, there's the second wave, beginning in December of 2019 in Sudan. In the working class city of Atbara, north of the capital Khartoum, led by secondary school students, the initial spark of the uprising was a threefold increase in the price of bread, showing you how key these basic elements like bread were to people's survival. Immediately, there was a march to parliament demanding that the government raise public sector wages and legalize unions, but security forces used violence against the protesters. This spurred strikes by workers in the key port city of Port Sudan, employees of banks, telecom workers, and private firms. Some may remember, and this was not so long ago, 2019, I believe, the viral image of the iconic photo of student Ela Salah, a woman wearing a white thobe dress and gold earrings, standing atop a car with her hand raised in the air, giving a speech to an enraptured crowd. It was but one symbol of their leadership at the forefront of the militant demonstrations. There was the establishment of youth-led resistance committees, which coordinated protests designed to emphasize sustainability over sheer numbers. This was, perhaps we could say, a case of learning from the shortcomings of previous uprisings in 2011. Finally, I believe it was April of 2019, Omar al-Bashir, who had ruled the country for 30 years, stepped down. But protests and sit-ins continued, demanding civilian rule. And in this moment of continued protest, there was also an iconic image of a train rolling into the capital, Khartoum, to support anti-military protests. The train was completely covered with human beings waving Sudanese flags, and they were met by massive crowds in the Khartoum station. In Algeria, there was a mass mobilization triggered by the announcement in February 2019 that President Abdelaziz Bouteflika would run for a fifth term. He had been in power since 1999, 20 years earlier, and had been incapacitated by a stroke since 2013. There were historic Friday marches every Friday for more than a year, followed by protests in the professional sectors demanding yetnahaw ga, they all need to go, and el bled bledna undiru rayna, the country is our country and we do as we like. Demanding, and these demands were the departure of Bouteflika, but also the rest of the shadowy Algerian political elite. There was a general strike in the first few weeks of the uprising, instrumental in forcing Bouteflika to abdicate. And there were mass marches across the country every Friday for over a year until COVID measures shut them down, and then a brief revival for a few months in 2021. This story of COVID measures shutting down or seriously constricting the protests and revolutionary movements goes for all of the movements I'm about to mention in this second wave. So I cut it out in a few countries because you can just take it as a given. In Lebanon, the revolution began in October 2019 while wildfires raged across the country and there were shortages in basic things like gas and bread. Rage was finally unleashed when the government announced highly regressive taxes, including one on the popular messaging app WhatsApp. Protesters in Beirut and other urban centers immediately began chanting Ash'ab Yurid Isqat al-Nizam, the people want the downfall of the regime, hearkening back to a famous 2011 slogan. And all politicians, regardless of sect or party, were named and shamed in the streets. They denounced the sectarian power-sharing system of government and Hukm al-Masraf, rule by banks. In Iraq, civil society organizations, student unions, civic-minded parties, longtime activists called for protests in October of 2019. Their grievances included unemployment, a lack of basic services, endemic corruption, and yes, a sectarian and ethnic power-sharing government. Gonna try and speed it up. Revolutionary art covered public spaces in Baghdad and major cities in Iraq. Under the slogan, "We want a homeland, Nurid Watan," impoverished Iraqi youth occupied squares in the center of Iraqi cities, refused the sectarian political system put in place by the American occupation, which allocated power along ethnic and sectarian lines. So this was a moment of tremendous hope for the continuation of the revolutionary process unleashed in 2011, with activists and observers seeing the vindication of their beliefs that the revolution would indeed carry on, and a belief that new revolutionaries had learned from the mistakes of the old ones, or of the ones who came before. But of course, like in any revolutionary situation, there was a reaction. In Lebanon, the protest movement was decentralized and had a cacophony of sometimes contradictory demands. This lack of cohesion provided an opportunity for political elites to infiltrate the movement, to undermine it, and settle scores with political rivals. In Iraq, massive state violence was used against protesters, killing hundreds and wounding thousands. Quite significant. After the U.S.'s assassination of Iran's military leader Qasem Soleimani in Iraq, mass marches were called against the U.S. in Iraq. This political leader who called for these mass marches, the marchers who went out actually ended up displacing the revolutionary protesters in Baghdad's main square of Tahrir, similarly named to Cairo. In Algeria, the COVID-19 pandemic, like all of the other countries in the second wave, forced the suspension in March 2020 of protests. Large-scale protests resumed in February 2021, but were suspended again in the summer of 2021 due to heavy state repression. There was the arrest of leading activists and organizers, as well as journalists and others, charging them with vague offenses such as harming national unity. In Sudan, after Bashir's overthrow, a power-sharing agreement was reached between military figures and the interim president. A sit-in in front of the military headquarters demanding civilian rule was violently dispersed, killing at least 120 people in 2019. The civilian half of the transitional government was overthrown in 2021, but Sudan erupted in mass protest and a general strike in response, with millions refusing military rule. Finally, in April 2023, we came to the situation where Sudan is in now. Full-scale war broke out between what are essentially formalized militias, the RSF, and the Sudanese army. Regional powers like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Russia became directly involved. Starvation became rampant amid sieges, and inter-ethnic violence was encouraged. Resistance committees, once a driving force and an organizing force behind the revolution, now work to provide community care and deliver food for basic survival. So, the second wave revolutions have both affirmed that the social, political, and economic dynamics that created the fuel for the first wave of uprisings still exists, largely untouched, as oppressive and flammable as ever. They also show that the obstacles to revolutionary social change are legion and vary from country to country. So let me name just a few of the ongoing contradictions, and there are many more. There's widespread economic immiseration, high unemployment, sectarian divide and rule, political systems, and intervention by foreign powers, not to mention mass exploitation of local resources. But there are openings for struggle. Continued immiseration means continued outbreaks of rebellion. There is rejection in many places of sectarian-based governance and greater cross-sect unity and solidarity. New organizing formations like the local coordinating committees in Syria, the resistance committees in Sudan, social media campaigns, community care initiatives in Sudan, Iraq, and Lebanon, the self-awareness of labor unions as a major force for change, revolutionary change, and experiments with autonomous local governance like the Kurds in Syria, Amazigh in Libya, and many more. And the greater activation of the mass of the population in the MENA region as they see their governments doing nothing to stop the genocide in Gaza, despite all kinds of rhetoric. So, in conclusion, we must ask, were these revolutions worth the massive price paid? There may not be one clear yes or no. What is clear, though, is that prior to 2011, capitalism and the imperialist struggle for resources and control in the MENA region, which it created, had made an intolerable status quo where ordinary people had nothing to lose but their chains. And while the counter-revolution has been swift and brutal, those who fought and continue to now carry an embodied experience of revolution, a knowledge of their own power. Revolutionary activists are learning new lessons from each other on how to overthrow despotic governments, overthrow economic systems crushing their livelihoods and the capitalist order that spawns them. And as one Syrian journalist told me recently, journalist and activist, one gain that cannot be denied in the Syrian revolution is the ability to think freely, to think of opposing Bashar al-Assad. The people decided to revolt in 2011 against the rule of a tyrannical system. As long as this people exists, the revolution and its principles live on, and this cannot be denied. So, now we might ask, where is the Arab Spring going now? And what will these revolutions achieve the next time they rise? Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.